The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by Alumni Ventures. Invest with confidence. Discover the power of venture investing with Alumni Ventures, America's largest venture firm for individual investors. Learn more at av.vc.
LinkedIn presents.
Howdy, everyone. This is the Next Big Idea Daily, and I'm your host, Michael Kovnet. It's Thursday, and if you follow the news, you probably know that Nikki Haley ended her presidential campaign yesterday, making it all but certain that this year's race will be between Donald Trump and Joe Biden, postponing once again the day when Americans might see a female president. With an uninterrupted history of men in the role, the United States is increasingly looking like an outlier among democracies. But what is it about American political culture that's kept women from the presidency for so long? NBC News correspondent Ali Vitali tackles this question in her book, Electable, Why America Hasn't Put a Woman in the White House Yet. Ali is covering this year's race, and she covered the 2020 presidential campaign too, a campaign that featured an unprecedented number of women candidates on the Democratic side. And even though Kamala Harris's election as vice president was historic, Ali digs deep into our past political history to understand why the top job has yet to go to a woman. Here's Ali to share some big ideas from the book.
Hey, I'm Ali Vitali, a Capitol Hill correspondent for NBC News. You may see me on The Today Show, Nightly News, MSNBC, our streaming platforms, in the halls of Congress, or out on the campaign trail. I covered the 2016 election cycle embedded with the Donald Trump campaign, the 2018 midterms on the road from Montana to Florida to Missouri, and then the 2020 presidential, following Joe Biden and Kamala Harris in the general election and jumping around the country with candidates like Amy Klobuchar and Elizabeth Warren in the Democratic primary before that. That was where my book, through a collision of my daily reporting combined with a great suggestion, was born. Exploring the idea that after 2016, when Hillary Clinton won the popular vote but not the presidency, and then seeing more women run in one presidential primary than ever before, but still ending up with a white man as the Democratic nominee, what would it take to break the tallest glass ceiling for women in politics? Why hadn't America elected a woman president yet? Big idea number one is the one that I felt governs this entire process, so much so that it's the title of the book, Electability. Everyone wants to back the candidate, man or woman, who can win, which is why electability is such an important metric and why the way gender factors into how it's assessed is so important. Understanding the biases at play and how they've manifested in recent election cycles for female candidates is the work of this book so that we can disrupt those trends in real time going forward, leveling the playing field for candidates of both genders. It was also the key question of the Democratic primary at a pivotal moment, mere weeks before the Iowa caucus in January 2020. Can a woman win? And also looming over the field, can a woman beat Donald Trump, especially after Hillary Clinton's loss in 2016? Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren sparred over these questions on the pre-caucus debate stage after news of a private dinner they had in 2018 broke in the news, and Warren said Sanders told her he didn't think a woman could win the presidential. Sanders denied that account, which thrust other dynamics about not believing women's on-the-record accounts over men's into focus as well. But the larger issue at play was an unanswerable question that the female candidates were being forced to answer in real time. Could they do what had never been done before? Win to be the first female president of the United States? Flying from Des Moines to Manchester, New Hampshire, the night of the Iowa caucus and before the New Hampshire primary, Warren was asked about these gender dynamics, how they played out in Iowa, and what she hears from voters about this. She was candid with the dozen of us traveling reporters sharing the private plane with her and her campaign. She said, "Everyone comes up to me and says, I would vote for you if you had a penis." Big idea number two is likability. Call it the younger sibling of electability. They're bound together, hard to unlink, especially for women, where being liked actually impacts their ability to get votes and thusly impacts their ability to win. It's a metric that dogged Hillary Clinton her entire time in political life. Most of us recall the debate stage moment in 2008 where then-Senator Barack Obama quipped that Clinton was likable enough after the moderator of that debate asked her what she'd say to those concerned about the likability issue. That question, despite voters agreeing that Clinton was the field's most experienced and electable candidate. Then, at the outset of her presidential run in 2016, The Washington Post revived the metric. Regardless of whether it's fair, it's a question that has followed Clinton, they wrote. And even if it's a double standard, it's still a potentially real factor for her when it comes to getting people to vote for her, at least theoretically. But it's more than theoretical. A study by the Barbara Lee Family Foundation found voters will support a male candidate they do not like, but who they think is qualified, but don't apply the same standard to women. It's called to mind the dozens upon dozens of voters I met who backed Trump, even though they didn't like his brash persona. Complicating things further is that if you're trying to make sure everyone likes you, it can be hard to do the work of differentiating yourself from the field or attacking your rivals, which is also part of the job of being a candidate. So women candidates must be more selective there, too. Big idea number three is proving qualifications. That same BLFF study had another finding in it. Women also have to do more to prove they're qualified. For men, their qualification is assumed. It's something that became a pivot point in the campaign conversation for Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg after Klobuchar was quoted in the New York Times as effectively saying a woman with equal or less experience than Buttigieg would struggle to be taken seriously as a presidential contender. Some in Klobuchar's orbit were reticent about engaging further, worried that by continuing to speak honestly about this gendered dynamic, it would sound like she was complaining about a rival's rise rather than speaking to sexist undertones in presidential politics. Being a woman who was also in the race for president, complaining about the unfair dynamics faced by a woman running for president could ring hollow or seem selfishly biased. But Klobuchar leaned in anyway. Not because, as she'd remind me, she wanted to run as a woman or win because of her gender, but because, as she saw it, it was just a fact that women had to do more to be taken seriously. Which, of course, was true. I just remember looking back on this news cycle and wondering how anyone could have seen it any other way. Big idea number four is the way we're currently assessing Vice President Kamala Harris. She's historic, glass ceiling breaking, trailblazing, the first woman and woman of color to hold that role, Madam Vice President. It's a milestone, and it also hasn't been an easy road so far. While I was reporting for both this book and for my day job at NBC, there were those who'd say Harris is doing a good job but getting a bad shake, and those who'd say she's falling short of expectations. To me, they all seem to come at it from the same place. Struggling for the metrics to assess her, in part because we expected that her newness would mean being tangibly different. Fundamentally unfair because, in theory, each new vice president is new, but also because it sets her up to fall short of expectations before she even begins. We didn't expect Pence or Biden or Cheney or Gore to reshape the office. Why suddenly is there an anxious foot-tapping for Kamala Harris to do so? The politics is inextricably linked with her identity, for better and for worse. Big idea number five is how this history finally happens. I cop to this. I don't know who the first female president will be. I have some ideas, sure, and I name some names in the book. I also share what multiple experts and former candidates have predicted, including Hillary Clinton, which is that despite Democrats being leaders in putting viable women forward into the candidate pipeline, the first woman to become president could very well be a conservative. History tells us that's how it's happened in other countries who've beaten us to this milestone already. Of course, in telling me this, Secretary Clinton allowed that it's not what she wants to see happen. She wants to see a Democrat. I hope in every single presidential election cycle we have going forward, it's not just one singular woman in a field of men, but several women, and that they'll be able to run on a more level playing field than the women who came before them.
Thank you, Allie. All right, everyone, that was a little foray into politics. Tomorrow, we'll switch gears and bring you some big ideas from New York Times Magazine writer Peggy Orenstein. She'll be sharing insights from her book, Unraveling, What I Learned About Life While Shearing Sheep, Dyeing Wool, and Making the World's Ugliest Sweater. Now, come on, how can you resist coming back to hear that? Meanwhile, take a moment and sign up for my newsletter using the link in the episode notes, or you can find it by searching for The Next Big Idea on LinkedIn. I'm Michael Kovnat. See you tomorrow.